Well, it's a joy to be with you here to think about Judges together. It's a whole book, 21 chapters, and we just have four sessions. Therefore, we're not going to cover all the stories and the whole book. So I apologize in advance if we don't get to your favorite story in Judges. But my aim isn't to do the impossible, to cover everything, but to try to point out how it works. And I want to just start by looking at the overview. Now, I hope you have an outline for the session, which you can make notes on that or make darts out of it or whatever you want. And the outline there, I just want you to look at. This has no more sanction than my own brain. This bar chart, the bar chart relates to the number of verses in each section. Okay, I just want to make a general observation, three general observations. It helps me at least to think of the shape of Judges. So there are three unequal sections. So firstly, there's the introduction, which is 1:1 to 3:6, and it lays the foundation of the understanding we need for the book. Then, of course, the bulk of the book is the Judges, which is 3:7 to 16:31. And the Judges, as you will probably be aware, they're not so much agents of court justice as agents of deliverance. Chapter 2:16, the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of those who plundered them. And the Judges, well, the accounts of the Judges include some quite fantastic and colourful stories and characters. There are 13 accounts. The one in the middle is this chap Abimelech, who we will sort of get to, who isn't a judge at all. So actually you're really left with 12 judges. 7 are covered very briefly, even if some of them were around for a long time. You see in the middle this chap Tola. We know almost nothing about him. He gets 2 verses, and yet he says he was judged for 23 years. 4 of them get sort of middling treatments, you know, like Ehud or Jephthah. And 2 of them get very special attention. You can see that, Gideon and Samson. And if you were preaching Judges, you would, you know, be strange not to give some emphasis to those two characters. And then at the end, there's the conclusion, the Levite and his idol and the Levite and his concubine. That's 17:1 to 21:25. Now, that's quite different in style. 2 chapters about the collapse of religious life, 3 chapters about the collapse of moral values. And it's pretty grim stuff, some of the grimmest reading in the Bible. It's basically about Israelites becoming Canaanites. Now, the easiest thing is to skip the introduction, a bit boring, and to avoid the conclusion, a bit grim, and just go for the great stories. Isn't that exciting? But if you do that, you kind of easily don't quite make sense of the whole. So I'm not going to do that. What I'm proposing in 4 sessions is to look at the introduction at the beginning and the conclusion at the end, which seems a sensible thing to do, and to take up 2 of the stories of the Judges. And I want to suggest that each section, that is introduction, the Judges, and the conclusion, you could sum up the issues in a question. The first one, as I put there on the outline, will we obey God or do we think we know better than God? That is a perennial question. Secondly, another perennial question, is God really sovereign when his people and our society are in a complete mess? It's a question you might want to ask even today, of course. And conclusion, where does sin take a society? And that's a relevant question. They're all relevant questions for us today. Now, so please follow me with the outline. And can I just say, I happen to be using the ESV. It's fine if you're using something else. And from time to time, we'll be discussing and talking in groups. So I hope you're a friend of the person next to you. And if you're not, you will become one. Okay. The challenge of Judges. Now, there is a problem that Judges throws in our faces right from the beginning, and we've got to deal with head on. It's not just that some of the stories are more than a trifle gory, but central to the book is what today our society would call ethnic cleansing. We can't preach Judges and avoid this issue. I expect some people avoid the book of Judges because of that issue. Judges, along with the book of Joshua, is about the Israelites invading, at God's command and purpose, the land of Canaan, which was already occupied. For example, I mean, the Bible is very upfront about this. Deuteronomy 7, 1 to 2. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it and clears away many nations before you, and then they're named, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than yourselves. And when the Lord God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them. The key phrase is devoted to complete destruction. And in case we didn't get the point, it's spelled out very clearly in Deuteronomy 20, 16 to 17. In no uncertain terms, I quote, "In the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes, but you shall devote them to complete destruction." And then it tells you again the names: the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded. Now, what are we to make of this? For some, that's simply horrifying. Well, firstly, just to stab at the issue, God himself is the heart of our problem. The command to destroy the Canaanites is specified as coming from God and comes again and again. Judges, like many books in the Bible, you need to be reading some of the earlier stuff to make sense of Judges. Deuteronomy 7, 1 to 5, 9 to 4, 5, 20 to 16 to 18, Exodus 23, 20, I've listed them there. Joshua says, Joshua 11, 20, "For it was the Lord's doing to harden their hearts, that they should come out against Israel in battle, in order that they should be devoted to destruction and should receive no mercy, but be destroyed, just as the Lord commanded Moses." One current commentator says, "Israel is not, as it is often suggested, the primary agent in the story, invading a land that belongs to someone else, motivated by a desire for territory, and then using divine sanction to justify it. Quite the opposite, actually. God is the primary agent of judgment, and he is using Israel as his instrument." So this is an act, an unusual act, of God's judgment on a particular people and culture. And the question for us is, does God have the right to judge? Now, our society will tell us, of course, that no one has the right to judge me. But the Bible tells us that God has created us, and he is the judge of all human beings. Abraham in Genesis 18, 25 said, "Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just, do what is right?" The answer is actually yes. So, God himself. Second, it's very unusual. Deuteronomy 20, 16 to 18, God gives laws about how Israel was to behave when at war. And they're commanded to offer terms of peace in war before besieging a city and in victory, if they do go to war there, to spare, quote, "the women and the little ones, the livestock and everything else in the city." It is only when invading Canaan that the entire enemy nation was to be devoted to destruction. And even then, those Canaanites who helped Israel were spared, as you find in chapter 1 here, and verse 25 in this town called, formerly called Luz, where one of the Canaanites showed them the way into the city, and it says that they let the man and all his family go. And also, one of those Canaanites who actually helped Israel in Jericho and turned to the God of Israel, Rahab, found refuge and mercy, such that Rahab, a Canaanite, ends up in the genealogy of the Christ in Matthew 1:5. So it is not, the problem is not their ethnicity. The problem is their behavior. And that brings us to the third point. It's judgment by God on a very depraved culture. Deuteronomy 9 verse 4 explains it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out before you. Gross sexual perversion was rampant. Baal worship involved cult prostitution to induce the Baals to bring fertility to the land. And Leviticus 18, 6 to 30 is the key text here. It lists incest, adultery, homosexuality, bestiality, and child sacrifice, and specifies, by all these things, the nations I'm driving out before you have become unclean, so that I punished its iniquity, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. It's pretty graphic language. That's in verses 24, 25 in Leviticus 18. And also, all sorts of occult practices, and the key text here is Deuteronomy 18, 9 to 14. Child sacrifice, which appears in both lists, divination, omens, sorcery, and mediums. And it says in verse 12 there, because of these abominations, the Lord your God is driving them out before you. So it was judgment on depravity. Fourth thing to say was long delayed. Because in Genesis 15, God said to Abraham, verse 13 to 16, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and it's thinking of Egypt, and will be afflicted for 400 years. But afterward, they will come out with great possessions, and they shall come back here. Now, he was in Canaan. Come back here in the fourth generation. And then it gives a very interesting reason at the end. For the iniquity of the Amorites, for which you could read Canaanites, it's a general term, is not yet complete. So God's timing for the Israelites to conquer Canaan and destroy the inhabitants was directly connected to their moral perversity reaching a certain pitch. So the clock was already ticking in Genesis 15, but it, you know, the alarm didn't go off until you get to Judges and Joshua. And the last point to say is the results of not obeying God, the consequences, were the corruption and destruction of Israelites, which is in a way what the book of Judges, much of it is about. They were warned in no uncertain terms. Deuteronomy 7:3, you shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. Deuteronomy 20, again, the command to devote them to destruction, that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices that they have done for their gods, and so you sin against the Lord your God. And the final chapters of the book show that when you ignore what God says, you live with the consequences. Okay, so the overall question I've suggested for this the introduction is, will we obey God, or do we think we know better? Now, we're going to take this in two bites. So to begin with, we're looking at Judges 1:1 to 2:5. And in a moment or so, we're going to read it. Okay, just to comment that this introductory bit is really a recap of what has already happened in the book of Joshua. It's not only a recap, but much of it's a recap. Joshua, whose death is mentioned in verse 1, you actually find he's still around, chapter 2, verse 6. When Joshua dismissed the people of Israel went, and he dies again later in verse 8. So it is, as it were, still in the presence of Joshua. And if we had read Joshua in advance of Judges, which of course we ought really to, you would keep thinking, ooh, I recognize that bit. Because there's loads of overlap. So the story of Othniel in 11 verse 15 is already there in Joshua 15. And the behavior of the Benjamites in verse 21 is also in Joshua 15. And Manasseh's behavior, 27 to 28, is also in Joshua 17. And Ephraim in verse 29, well, that's also in Joshua 16. It's deliberately interlocking. So we're going to read 1:1 to 2:5. Okay. And I'm going to ask for volunteers to read nice and loud and not too slow, not too fast either. Okay, so could I have someone read 1 to 15, please? Thank you. And then someone read 16 to the end of the chapter. Thank you. And someone read 1 to 5. Thank you. Okay, be bold and go for it and follow it carefully. And can I just say, there are questions following this that I'm hoping that you will think about. What's the general feature of the first half? What encouraging signs are there in this verses 1 to 19? What's the general feature of the second half? Where's the tipping point? What are the repeated phrases? Why do things go wrong? How might these verses be relevant today? Okay, so those are the questions we'll be talking about after we've read it. So please start reading.
Judges chapter 1, verses 1 to 15, beginning to read. After the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, "Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" The Lord said, "Judah will go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand." And Judah said to Simeon his brother, "Come up with me into the territory allotted to me, that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I likewise will go with you into the territory allotted to you." So Simeon went with him. Then Judah went up, and the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand. And they defeated 10,000 of them at Bezek. They found Adoni Bezek at Bezek, and fought against him and defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Adoni Bezek fled, but they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and his big toes. And Adoni Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off used to pick up scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me." And they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. And the men of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it, and struck it with the edge of the sword, and set the city on fire. And afterwards the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites, who lived in the hill country, and in the Negev, and in the lowland. And Judah went up against the Canaanites, who lived in Hebron. Now, the name Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba. And they defeated Sheshai, and Ahiman, and Talmai. From there they went against the inhabitants of Debir. And the name of Debir was formerly Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, "He who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captures it, I will give him Achash, Aksa, my daughter, as wife." And Othniel, and the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, captured it. And he gave him Aksa, his daughter, as wife. When she came to him, she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Give me a blessing, since you have given me the land of the Negev. Give me also springs of water." And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs.
The descendants of Moses' father-in-law, the Canaanite, went up from the city of
Sorry, can I just stop you there? It's Kenites, is that right? He's not a Canaanite.
Sorry, the Kenites.
Right, okay. Sorry, it's just an important distinction. Apologise, please, you're doing a great job. Keep going.
The descendants of Moses' father-in-law, the Kenite, went up from the city of Palms with the men of Judah to live among the people of the desert of Judah in the Negev near Arad. Then the men of Judah went with the Simeonites, their brothers, and attacked the Canaanites, living in Stephath, and they totally destroyed the city. Therefore, it was called Hormah. The men of Judah also took Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron, each city with its territory. The Lord was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country, but they were unable to drive the people from the plains, because they had iron chariots. As Moses had promised, Hebron was given to Caleb, who drove it with with the sons of Anak. The Benjamites, however, failed to dislodge the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. To this day, the Jebusites live there with the Benjamites. Now the house of Joseph attacked Bethel, and the Lord was with them. When they sent men to spy out Bethel, formerly called Luz, and the spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, "Show us how to get into the city, and we will see that you are treated well." So he showed them, and they put the city to the sword, but spared the man and his whole family. He then went to the land of the Hittites, where he built a city, and called it Luz, which is its name to this day. But Manasseh did not drive out the people of Beth Shan, or Tanakh, or Dor, or Ibleam, or Megiddo, and their surrounding settlements, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that land. When Israel became strong, they pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but never drove them out completely. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites living in Gaza, but the Canaanites continued to live there among them. Neither did Zebulun drive out the Canaanites living in Kitron or Nahalal, who remained among them, but they did subject them to forced labor. Nor did Asher drive out those living in Echo or Sidon or Ahala or Akzib or Helba or Aphek or Rehob. And because of this, the people of Asher lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. Neither did Naphtali drive out those living in Beth Shemesh or Beth Anan. But the Naphtalites too lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. And those living in Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath became forced laborers for them. The Amorites confined the Danites to the hill country, not allowing them to come down into the plain. And the Amorites were determined also to hold out in Mount Heres, Ajion, and Shalabim. But when the power of the house of Joseph increased, they too were pressed into forced labor. The boundary of the Amorites was from the Scorpion Pass to Sela and beyond.
Now the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, "I brought you up from Egypt, and brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. What is this you have done? So now I say, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become thorns in your sides, and their gods shall be a snare to you." As soon as the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the people of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and wept, and they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there to the Lord.
Right. Okay, thank you for reading. Lots of names I don't quite know how to pronounce, but you did a great job. Right, now, can you please look at those questions? Now, we really haven't got as much time as I'd like us to have, inevitably, but I'm going to give you a bit of time to think about those questions. You've got space here if you wanted to scribble some responses, and please do talk about it with the people next to you. Okay, what's the general feature of the first half? Some of the encouraging signs, general feature second half, where's it changed, repeated phrases, what goes wrong, and so on. And we need to do this right now, so please go for it. Thank you. Satan's back. I don't want part of that. Stranded all by yourself.
Oh, yeah, I'm at the bookshop. I'm just listening in.
Oh,
that's
right.
Okay.
Okay.
No, it's good,
okay. Well, you're very welcome if you wanted to. Mm-hmm.
Your mic from your pocket, is that all right? I want to make sure.
Wait,
yeah, no, you're
thing.
Not. That's fine. No, that's
is that okay?
Yeah, yeah. Because of where I was sitting, I wasn't completely sure you weren't muted, but I checked with my colleagues and they said it sounds fine.
And this other thing is doing whatever it's doing. Yeah, yeah, fine. Pray. Lord, I pray that you'd help me to give them enough time. Good to see the scribbles. You're always there. Well done. You're still here.
I'm still here. You know, I slotted in just after a while.
Good.
I need to leave to go and see someone.
That's fine. You just do whatever you need to. Thank you.
Thank you.
So encouraging to see all these scribbles.
Are you,
well, what I mean is handwriting. Right. Are you talking with someone else, or are you just sort of... Great, lovely.
just practical, right?
Yes. Yes.
And also, if we had, we're just writing it down, but not really been talking. If you were to give us about 2 minutes, we can compare notes.
Yeah, before please. Yes.
No, but you let us know when we've got the last 2 minutes.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Going to give you a couple more minutes. I hope you're well on. It looks as though you're doing very nicely, most of you, as far as I can see. Jesus, I pray. Okay, everybody. Sorry to abbreviate your conversations. Okay. I hope you will be forthcoming from in response to my questions. So the first one, the general feature of the first half of the passage. Anybody? They were successful. It's a positive story. Okay, you began to say some of the positive signs. You mentioned, what did you say?
Is this one of the six?
Yes.
Through, yes.
Just give me one.
I said that they, is it like they were obeying God, verse 3? So that was going on.
Right. Good, they were obeying God.
And God gave them over, so it was God basically doing what
yeah.
He said.
Yeah, God was actively helping them. Something else? Positive? Right, it starts great way, doesn't it? They pray. Inquire, always a sign of health of Israel when they prayed and of Christians. Okay, anything else? Right, cooperation. Now, we may not realize it when we first read this, but that's quite a big issue in the book of judges, because it isn't always like that. Okay, so you've got prayer, you've got the Lord's help, and promise, of course, in verse 2. Cooperation, anything else that's encouraging? Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, Caleb, the whole story of Othniel's family is a story of...
fertility and future.
Yeah, it's a faith, isn't it? Trusting God and provision, and you're quite right, the water in the desert is very important. Anything else?
I thought it was interesting, coming from a slightly different angle, that Adonai Bezek recognised God.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yes, he recognized the justice of God's judgment on him, meted through the Israelites. But he said, this is entirely just. You know, when you first read this story, you think, oh, how gruesome. And then the guy himself says, well, this is absolutely what I deserved. Which is, in a way, a microcosm of the story of the Canaanites. Yeah. And it is interesting. You don't know. Where did that go? Did it go anywhere? Well, who knows? Okay, anybody want to add anything? Right. And that phrase, this town in verse 17 that had been called Zephath, then becomes known as Hormah, which means utter destruction. And they're obeying God. Okay. And you get these interesting characters in verse 10. Do you notice them? Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. And they're actually also in verse 20, the three sons of Anak. And had we been reading in Joshua, these guys absolutely terrified the living daylights out of the Israelites, because they were giants. And when the spies initially went, when they first came over and God told Moses that they were to enter the land, they sent spies and they were absolutely freaked out by these guys. And the report came back that the land was full of these giants. And it wasn't, but there were some. So the destruction of these three men is actually a significant moment, this whole backstory. Right, general feature of the second half of the... Somebody who hasn't said anything? Second half of the book, chapter?
Failure.
Right, very nicely summarised. Success, the first half. Failure, the second half. Where does it begin to tip? Suggestions?
Iron chariots in verse 19.
Right, verse 19, where... That's the first sense they could not drive out, and it sort of gathers momentum from then on, doesn't it? Verse 21, they did not drive out. Okay, right. Repeated phrases. Someone from this side, give me a repeated phrase.
Forced labor.
Forced labor. Okay, they enforced, they made the living Canaanites, they subjected them to forced labor. We're going to come back to that. Right, okay. Forced labour. Another thing over on this side.
Did not drive out.
And that comes, the first one in 19 is could not. And then verse 21, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33. You get the point. They did not drive out. One after the other, after the other, after the other. Runs through. It's the most frequent phrase. They did not drive out. Okay, but we know they were commanded originally to drive out. Any other repeated phrase? Middle block.
Neither.
Neither what?
Well, it keeps saying, neither this tribe did it, nor that tribe did it. They all kind of...
Yeah, thank you. I hadn't observed that, but you're absolutely right. It's part of the how widely spread this was. Another phrase? Anyone? Sorry, say it again.
Continued to live there. I know we said they were slaves, but by living there...
Right. What's the specific phrase? They lived among. Now, there's a switch in the phrase, if you begin to look carefully. The Canaanites, verse 21, in this case the Jebusites, lived with the people of Benjamin in Jerusalem. Okay? And then verse 29. The Canaanites lived in Gezer. So the Canaanites lived in Gezer among them. And verse 30, the Canaanites lived among. So you get the sense the predominant community was Israelite, but then the Canaanites lived among them. And then it switches. And it first switches in verse 32. Then the Asherites lived among the Canaanites. So the predominant community becomes Canaanite. And the same in verse 33. The Naphtali, they lived among the Canaanites. And then we have, anything else? Verse 34, there's almost a hint of a counter-conquest. The Amorites pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, and what happened to Dan is going to be significant in the story. Okay, so, brilliant. Any explanation of why things went wrong? Right, as simple as that. Verse 2, but you have not obeyed my voice. How might these things be relevant today, given that we're not conquering Canaan? What's going on?
Well, if we don't obey the law, we're not going to defeat sin in that sense.
That's right. And this sort of progress. It's a process you might call a process. What sort of process is it that's going on in the second part of the chapter?
It's like being assimilated, assimilation.
Simulation, compromise. Seems to me it's a process of compromise by God's people with the world around. And at first, I think it's so interesting, the consequences are minor and inconsequential, and you hardly notice them. And then they snowball until they become the norm. And then they come up with alternatives to full obedience. What was the alternative to full obedience?
Weapon offered sacrifice.
Well, that we're going to come to that. But in that, in this first section, what did they start to do instead of destroying the Canaanites? Forced labor is a partial obedience. I think Satan loves us to do partial obedience. Oh, well, you know, I do go to church or whatever it is. A partial obedience, but not in the matters, in some ways, that matter more. And the next generation live out the full implications, as we shall see in chapter 2, verse 10, when there arose another generation who did not know the Lord. And it brought God's judgment, just as God wants. So the key question that I put at the beginning is, will we obey God because we trust him? Or will we only obey when what he commands is obviously reasonable in our eyes? And today, I think that's a huge issue. It's a real pressure. The values around pressurizing from our society, but also even within the evangelical world, you know, pressure to adjust our view of the authority of the Bible or homosexuality or the sanctity of life. Some votes in Parliament today, aren't there, about abortion or roles in marriage or male headship in church leadership or understanding the wrath of God and penal substitution, or marriage to unbelievers, or divorce and remarriage issues, the Lord's Day, all sorts of things where folk who call themselves evangelical have shifted, or some of them, significantly from what used to be understood to be what God's word taught. And it is a question for every one of us. Will we obey because God says it, or we obey because it just seems reasonable to us? And a good summary of where things stand at the end of this opening section is from Tim Keller, I put down there. The Israelites now live alongside idol-worshipping Canaanites. Like buried mines, these idols lie dormant in Judges 1, ready to explode in the spiritual lives of God's people. That's a brilliant summary. Can I just make a comment on Tim Keller? In the course of our day, I'm going to be disagreeing with Keller on a number of occasions and absolutely agreeing with him on other occasions. And I just want to say I have the greatest, well, he's in heaven now, but I've always had the greatest respect for Tim Keller. So even when I dissent from him, I honour him, and I want you to know that in advance. Okay, so we come to the next section, which is Judges 2:6, the next part of the introduction. and to 3:6, which we're going to read together. And I would like, again, some volunteers. So 2:6, verse 6 in chapter 2 to verse 15. Could I have a volunteer? Thank you. Chapter 16 to the end of the chapter, 23. Thank you. And chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. Important verses I'm going to ask Spencer to read. He wasn't expecting that. Okay, just keep him awake. Right, let's go.
Chapter 2, verse 6. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to his their own inheritance. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110, and they buried him in the land of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. After that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They aroused the Lord's anger because they forsook him and served Baals and Ashtaroths. In his anger against Israel, the Lord gave them into the hands of the raiders who plundered them. He sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress.
Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshipped them. They quickly turned from the ways of their ancestors who had been obedient to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord relented because of their groaning under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their ancestors, following other gods and serving and worshipping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, because this nation has violated the covenant I ordained for their ancestors and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of the Lord and walk in it as their ancestors did. The Lord had allowed those nations to remain. He did not drive them out at once by giving them into the hand of Joshua.
Now these are the nations that the Lord left to test Israel by them. That is, all in Israel who had not experienced all the wars in Canaan. It was only in order that the generations of the people of Israel might know war, to teach war to those who had not known it before. These are the nations, the five lords of the Philistines and the Canaanites and the Sidonians and the Hivites who lived in Mount Lebanon. From Mount Baal, Lebanon, as Lebo Hamath. They were for the testing of Israel, to know whether Israel would obey the commandments of the Lord, which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. So the people of Israel lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And their daughters took to themselves for wives, and their own daughters they gave to their sons.
Right, now this is the second half of the introduction, and it is different to the first half. The first half is largely recapping. You know, Joshua is still around at the end of the first half. But the second half is looking forward. It is a theological overview of the whole book. And it is significant because we're meant to remember this when we're reading the later chapters. Because in the chapters that follow, there's very often limited or no theological interpretive comment. some, but not much. And you might wonder, well, where is God? And that's why you need to read these verses first. And the thing about this section is it's just full of the name of names of God. In 24 verses, the name Yahweh, the most holy name of God, comes 22 times. God comes once, and when God is speaking, me, I, and then of God, he, comes 19 times. That makes 42 references to the Lord in 24 verses. So it's saturated with God, and it tells us something significant. God is here, even when we think we don't see him. Because this is looking forward when you might have thought God is not present or doesn't seem to be. So what is this about? Well, I think it's about two things. I've called it first the story of God's inevitable anger, and secondly, the story of God's inexplicable mercy. Okay, inevitable anger. Now, it begins well, like the first section did. So Joshua in verse 6 dismisses the people. Verse 7. Incidentally, would you notice they went to each inheritance to take possession of the land? There's a job still to be done. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived him. Okay, who'd seen all the great works the Lord had done. So this is quite good. But there's an ominous fact that we've already read in verse 2 that the Lord has warned them. They have not obeyed his voice. And so there's that ominous verse 2, but there's also an ominous verse 10. Because after Joshua is buried, verse 10, and all that generation were gathered to their fathers, they've died, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. Now, isn't that a remarkable statement? And what can it mean? I mean, they must have known about the Lord. But they didn't know the Lord. They would have had, I mean, we will read the word the Lord does appear. And yet they didn't know the Lord. Satan loves to tie faith and serving God to the identity of a past generation. Thus it becomes exciting and contemporary to turn away from God. And I think that's one of the things that's happening here. Now, what do? Well, they abandon or forsook the Lord, verses 11 and onwards. They did evil. They abandoned the Lord. There are two parallel statements. Verse 12, they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers who brought them out of the land of Egypt. And verse 13, they abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Asherahs. So they substituted the pagan gods of the Canaanites for the living God of Israel. And we get the series of tragic verbs in verses 11 to 13, that they did evil, that they served the Baals, that they went after other gods, that they bowed down to him, and they provoked the Lord, and they abandoned the Lord, and they served the Baals. Serving the Baals involved all sorts of really, well, cult prostitution. And these are Israelites. Therefore, the anger of the Lord, verse 12, B, they provoke the Lord to anger. There's a double statement. Again, the double statement. Verse 12, they provoke the Lord to anger. Verse 14, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And you get that tragic little word, against. Against. That is, it comes twice. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. Verse 15, the hand of the Lord was against them from harm. So God is against his people because they've decided he isn't their God after all. They don't want him. So verse 14, the Lord gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. He sold them into the hands of their enemies. Now, this is important because when we therefore read about the disarray and weakness of Israel, this is not a sign that Israel's God is weak and irrelevant. In fact, what you're looking at is directly attributed to God himself. So when you drive past a church that has become a cinema or, you know, Indian restaurant or whatever it is, what are you looking at? Isn't that terrible? Well, I rather think you're probably looking at the finger of God in judgment on a church that ceased to trust the Bible. I'm not saying I'm in favor of churches being turned into cinemas, but I am saying that we may well be looking at what's happening here. God's judgment. So here the disarray of Israel is directly attributed to God's sovereign activity. For example, just look at 3 verse 12. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel. Turn over to chapter 4 verse 2. They did evil, verse 1, and the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, king of Canaan. Chapter 6, verse 1, people of Israel did evil, and the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian 7 years. Chapter 10, verse 7, I'm just trying to make the point, it runs and runs. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the Ammonites. 13, verse 1. And the people of Israel did evil in the eyes of the Lord, so the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. So actually, this is part of the sovereignty of God, that he acts in judgment. And at the end of all this, we could well say, well, going back to Judges 2 and 3, of course, for all their distress, verse 15, was as the Lord had warned and as the Lord had sworn to them. So the anger of God is never an unpredictable flare-up. And there's an important verse, word at the beginning of verse 14. In English, it appears as the word so. And it's there again in verse 20. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against them. Same phrase. And it led, therefore, to judgment. Verse 21, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left. In fact, that's how the whole chapter began in verse 3. I will not drive them out before you. And here in verse 21, it ends. I will not drive them out before you. The Israel's disobedience actually predates Judges. I mean, look in verse 21, I will no longer drive them out before any of them, any of the nations that Joshua left when he died. Verse 23, not driving them out quickly, and he did not give them into the hand of Joshua. And that's interesting. It means that this process of disobeying God had already begun in Joshua's day, and it tells us something important, that the greatest leaders do not guarantee the hearts of God's people. So you see that Moses and the Exodus generation, great leader, wayward people. Joshua and the conquest generation, great leader and increasingly disobedient people. And there is a purpose to test Israel. Verse 22, to test Israel, whether they will take care to walk in the way of the Lord as their fathers did. And chapter 3, verse 4, the same testing to know whether Israel would obey the commandments of the Lord. A test reveals what is inside us. Some of us no doubt have had medical tests to find out what on earth's going on, okay? And God tests our hearts, whether we will obey him or decide that we know better than God. And that's the key test. So, story of judgment, but secondly, a story of it's inevitable anger, but it's also a story of inexplicable mercy. There's a remarkable little word at the beginning of verse 16, which is the word then. Then the Lord raised up judges. Well, he's just said how the Lord was marching, was against Israel and opposing Israel. They were under wrath. Then the Lord raised up judges. In the same word, well, it's actually just one letter in the Hebrew. It's there in verse 18. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them. It's remarkable. It's mercy out of the blue. We don't say at this point, of course, the Lord raised up judges. Well, that's just what I was expecting. No, they're under the judgment they deserved. It's inexplicable. And of course, it says in verse 16, then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of those who plundered them. And this wasn't one off. It's a whole sequence. 12 judges who saved them. And yet, verse 17, they did not listen to their judges, for they hoard after other gods and bow down to them. They soon turned aside. Okay? They soon turned aside. And the Lord, of course, knew that. And he still raised up the judges. Inexplicable mercy. And it's the same in verse 18. Whenever the Lord raised up the judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord is moved to pity. But, verse 19, whenever the judge died, they turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods and serving them and bowing down to them. They did not drop any of their practices and their stubborn ways. It's a tragic story of how they turn back. And you'll notice two things. Firstly, God uses agents. The Lord raised up judges. And while the judges were alive, the nation was kept faithful. Now, the judges were not perfect, as we shall see. But this is the normal pattern. God uses leaders, and leaders impact the spiritual welfare of a whole community. That's true in a family, true in a church, true in a nation. Supreme agent is Jesus himself. He uses agents. Secondly, there's a spiral downwards that marks the whole book of Judges. With the first four to five judges, we will see there's a formula. The land had rest. Sometimes, you can see it, for example, in verse 11 of chapter 3, so the land had rest for 40 years. That was after Othniel, and sometimes it was for 80 years. But that formula disappears after Gideon. The defects of the judges become more obvious. And you end up with a car crash, that is chapters 17 to 21, when everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And yet, even in that spiral downward, God's still on the job somehow, raising up those judges. Extraordinary. And yet there is an explanation. It's there in verse 18. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and he saved them. For, middle of the verse, for the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who afflicted them and oppressed them. The source of hope for God's people is not them. It's not us. It's not what we are about. But the source of hope is the character of God, that we have a God like this, a God who knows that we will revert to sin and yet he saves us and responds in mercy where he has no... It is inexplicable, and yet it is explicable because of the character of our God. Revelation 7:10, when there is the great multitude that no one can number from every nation and all tribes and peoples and languages standing before the throne, they cry out, salvation belongs to our God. In other words, salvation is all about him. It's not all about us who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And that famous verse, of course, God so loved the world that he gave. Inexplicable, except for God's mercy. And there is a final mystery. Do have a look. Got to get this. Verses 5 and 6, the end of chapter, verse 3, 5 and 6. So, the people of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and their daughters. They took to themselves for wives, and their own daughters they gave to their sons, and they served their gods. Now, this is an appalling climax. There are three horrors. They lived among, they married into, and they served their gods. And it is a point-by-point reversal of God's command in Deuteronomy 7, 1 to 5. I mean, it really is. It's as if they ticked off, oh, we won't do that, and we won't do that, and we won't do that. The Lord said, you see, you must devote them. And he specifies the Hittites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. You must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them, and they don't destroy them. And then he says, verse 3 of Deuteronomy 7, you shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So they tick that one. Oh, we're going to intermarry with them. And the final one, they served their gods. In in Deuteronomy 7:5, thus you shall deal with them. You shall break down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and chop down their asherim and burn their carved images with fire. They completely, point by point, reversed what God had commanded. And therefore, it is a remarkable fact that Judges does not end at chapter 3, verse 6. And it's a remarkable fact that the book of Judges is not the last book in the Old Testament. And indeed, it keeps being remarkable that when, you know, for example, the exile, when they're under judgment, Israel was brought back. And of course, the most remarkable fact of all is when God came in person, we crucified him. And God still worked salvation for mankind. And one of the messages of Judges is that God's saving purposes, motivated by his own character, will not and cannot be defeated. Now, concluding literally 1 minute look, it's a typo there. Chapter 3, verse 7 to 15, I want you to have a look closely, and I'm going to read it, and I want you looking, is there a pattern? Is there a similarity between what happened about Othniel and what happened about Ehud? Okay, or those two sections. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asheroth. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. He sold them into the hands of this impossible to pronounce name, Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia. And the people of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years. But when the people of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer from the for the people of Israel who saved them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. The Spirit of the Lord was upon him, and he judged Israel. He went out to war, and the Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand, and his hand prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. So the land had rest for 40 years, and Othniel, son of Kenaz, died. And verse 12, people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He gathered to himself the Ammonites and the Amalekites, and they went and defeated Israel, and they took possession of the city of the palms. That's Jericho. And the people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and he raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, a left-handed man. Wonderful story. We're not doing it, I'm afraid. Okay, just observe. Is there a pattern in the two stories? Tell me the pattern. The
pattern is they did evil, forgot the Lord. The Lord gives them over to the bad guy.
Yes.
The bad guy rules over them for a period.
Yes.
They cry out to the
yes.
Lord, and then as a result, he saves them. He appoints the judge.
Brilliant. That's absolutely right. You can sum it up in different languages. But in four words, sin, servitude, supplication, salvation. Sin, servitude, supplication, salvation. Sin, so keeps happening. Sin, servitude, supplication, salvation. They all begin with S, even if the language is a bit outdated. There we go. Let's pray. Father, thank you that you've put your word here for our instruction. And Lord, we do so pray that we may not just be academically analyzing, but we may be also spiritually receptive. We ask your deliverance from compromising hearts, which we all have if Satan has his way. Help us to obey you because we trust you. In Jesus' name. Amen.